Let me invite you to take your Bibles and open them to the book of 1 Samuel, chapter 18. 1 Samuel, chapter 18. We all know the story of David and Goliath. David was just a young man when that incident took place, and he was propelled from obscurity to stardom through that one event. He had come from a sheep pasture. He had been ridiculed by his older brothers when he came and exhibited distress at the taunts of Goliath. But when his rock sunk into Goliath's forehead, and he took the sword of that giant and beheaded the man before two amazed armies, it was only a matter of days before his name was known throughout the length and the breadth of the land. He moved from sheep pasture to palace, because the text tells us that Saul had him move immediately into the palace to be there with him. But what looked like a bright future in the palace with the king, what looked like a life of ease and comfort, would soon become the most difficult years of young David's life. Saul would develop an insane jealousy of David, and he would attempt to take his life. And when David fled, Saul would pursue, hounding David, chasing him up and down the land, back and forth. And God knew that David would need a friend in high places, through these treacherous times. And so he gave him the very best of friends in Jonathan. Jonathan, the son of the king, the one who would become king. And in 1 Samuel chapter 18, there in the last part of that first verse, we read, Jonathan became one in spirit with David, and he loved him as himself. Well, Saul's jealousy flared almost the instant that David moved into the palace. You remember the story, don't you? Pretty soon, the song that became the most popular song in the land, the song that was on the hit parade, was entitled, Saul has slain his thousands, but David his tens of thousands. And Saul didn't like that song. He didn't like it when people walked by the palace humming that tune. He didn't like the words to that tune. He didn't like anything about it because it made David look good and him look bad. And down in verse 8 of chapter 18, we read Saul was very angry. This refrain galled him. They have credited David with tens of thousands, he thought, but me with only thousands. What more can he get but the kingdom? And from that time on, Saul kept a jealous eye on David. Well, in one of his dark moods, and these moods began to come on Saul more and more frequently, in one of his dark moods, he attempted to take the life of David. There in verse 10, it says, the next day an evil spirit from God came forcibly upon Saul. He was prophesying in his house while David was playing the harp, as he usually did. Saul had a spear in his hand, and he hurled it, saying to himself, I'll pin David to the wall. But David eluded him twice. Saul had what today we would almost describe as a manic depressive kind of an attitude. And he goes from highs to lows and back again. He goes on to say, shortly after that, he offered his daughter to David in marriage, if David would lead his military campaigns. But he didn't want David for a son-in-law. He wanted David to be out there on the front lines fighting the Philistines in the hope that David would get himself killed. And so in verse 17, we read about the arrangement that he made. Saul said to David, here is my older daughter, Merib. I will give her to you in marriage. Only serve me bravely and fight the battles of the Lord. For Saul said to himself, I will not raise a hand against him. Let the Philistines do that. Isn't it interesting that many years later, David used that very same ploy against Uriah the Hittite after he had taken Uriah's wife? In David's case, it was a successful ploy. But the Lord here protects David, and he gives him success in every battle, and David goes into the heat of the battle, and he comes out victorious time and time again. So rather than Saul achieving his aims, he is only growing more and more jealous of the reputation of David as it grows among the people. Now let me pause a moment, because we started out in the chapter talking about Jonathan and this kindred spirit that he had with David. And I want to talk about friendship and then watch as this friendship develops. Someone has suggested that we have been successful in life if we have enough close friends to serve as pallbearers at our funeral. And maybe that is one gauge of your success in having friends. While we may have many acquaintances, most of us have a much smaller number of true friends, close friends. There's an unspoken rule of life that the higher the value, the rarer the commodity. That's true in education. We understand that. If you took the total number of folks that have been through grade school, you'd have a lot of people in this land. If you move on up to a little bit higher level of education and say, how many of you have your high school diploma or your GED? Well, the number's going to be a little bit smaller there. If you move on up to the bachelor's degree level, the higher the value of the education, the fewer you have. You get to the PhD level. There aren't many PhDs out there, not compared to the total population. It's true in the area of wealth. How many people can work for minimum wage? Well, nearly everyone could get a minimum wage job. And then you move on up into middle income, and there are fewer people working in middle income jobs than there are at the lower level. When you move into the area of millionaires, it gets more and more narrow. When it gets to the level of billionaires, I looked this up this afternoon. You know how many billionaires there are that live in the United States of America? 403. You know, the more value, the rarer the commodity. And the same is true with friendships. We all have many, many acquaintances. How many people do you recognize their face? If you're in the mall and see them, and you'll speak to them, and then you'll think, now, where do I know them from? And then, oh, yeah, they work at the bank, or they work at the grocery store, or I met them here. And so we have all these acquaintances people will give nodding acquiescence to. Then there's a circle of people that we've worked with or we've known through school or through our children, and it's a wide circle. And then it becomes more narrow, the people that we socialize with, the ones that we may go out and have a cup of coffee with or invite into our home or do things socially with, go to a ball game. But then you narrow that down to close friends, and finally, to this level that existed between Jonathan and David of being soulmates. How many people do you have? The number gets incredibly small the further up the scale we move. Someone has asked, how can I tell the difference between my social friends and those who are true friends? Well, it's easy to tell the difference. Just get in trouble and see who comes to your rescue. See who stands by you through those hard times. Those are your true friends. Damon read the passage out of Ecclesiastes 4 at the beginning, where it says, two are better than one because they have good reward for their labor. For if they fall, one will lift up his companion, but woe to him who is alone when he falls, for he has no one to help him up. That word in Hebrew for good reward, when it says they have good reward for their labor, two friends rather than one, it can also be translated, they are a good investment. Did you ever think of it like that? the time you spend investing in and developing a relationship with another human being is time well spent. That is a great investment. The best investment, I believe, that you can make in this life is the investment of a good friend. Well, David made a good investment when he and Jonathan developed the friendship that they had. When he needed that friend, Jonathan was there for him. Look in chapter 19, the first few verses there. Saul has decided that he wants everyone else to join in his hatred of David, his jealousy, and so he asks them to all enlist in his campaign of murderous assault. And it says there in 19 verse 1, Saul told his son Jonathan and all the attendants to kill David. But Jonathan was very fond of David and warned him, "My father Saul is looking for a chance to kill you. Be on your guard tomorrow morning. Go into hiding and stay there. I will go out and stand with my father in the field where you are. I'll speak to him about you and will tell you what I find out." So Jonathan spoke well of David to Saul his father, and he said to him, "Let not the king do wrong to his servant David. He's not wronged you. And what has he done? And what he has done has benefited you greatly. He took his life in his hands when he killed the Philistine. The Lord won a great victory for all Israel, and you saw it and were glad. Why then would you do wrong to an innocent man like David by killing him for no reason?" And Saul listened to Jonathan and took this oath, "As surely as the Lord lives, David will not be put to death." Jonathan saved his friend's life. He went to bat for him. He stood up for him. Had David been alone, David would have been dead. Now, a friend is one who will go to bat for you in time of crisis. Jonathan defended his friend and he persuaded his father Saul to change his mind about having David killed. But if you're familiar with this story, you know it didn't last long. Look down in verse 8. Right after he swore an oath that he would not kill David, it says, once more, verse 8, war broke out. And David went out and fought the Philistines, and he struck them with such force that they fled before him. But an evil spirit from the Lord came upon Saul as he was sitting in his house with his spear in hand. And while David was playing the harp, Saul tried to pin him to the wall with his spear. But David eluded him as Saul drove the spear into the wall. That night, David made good his escape. David learned his lesson. Don't play the harp when Saul has a spear in his hand. And he made his escape once and for all from the palace, and he ran for his life. But he remembered his friend. Look over at this encounter we read of in chapter 20, first four verses. It says, "Then David fled from Naoth at Ramah, and he went to Jonathan and asked, 'What have I done? What is my crime? How have I wronged your father that he is trying to take my life?'" Now, Jonathan was not apparently aware that his father was bent on his murder. He had heard Saul swear that he wouldn't take his life. Apparently, he wasn't in the palace when Saul threw his spear. He wasn't aware that Saul was secretly chasing David. And so, Jonathan denies the reality that Saul is trying to kill David. Jonathan says in verse 2, "Never," Jonathan replied, "you're not going to die. Look, my father doesn't do anything, great or small, without confiding in me. Why would he hide this from me? It's not so." But David took an oath and said, "Your father knows very well that I have found favor in your eyes, and he has said to himself, 'Jonathan must not know this, or he will be grieved.' Yet as surely as the Lord lives and as you live, there is only a step between me and death." Jonathan said to David, "Whatever you want me to do, I'll do for you." Have you got a friend like that? A friend that if you went to them with a life or death situation, that they would simply say, "Whatever you need me to do, I'll do it. You need me to write a check? How much do you need? You need me to come and be with you? I'll come stay with you as long as you need me to. Whatever you need me to do, I will do. Folks, let me tell you, friends like that are rare. And they are extremely, extremely valuable. Well, David says, this is what I want you to do. I want you to sound out your father. And the way you need to do that, at the banquet, at the palace, when my name comes up, I want you to start speaking well of me. And I want you to watch your father's reaction if you take my side, if you stand up for me. And so Jonathan said, I will, and I'll find out for sure whether my father is intent on your murder. So he goes to the palace, goes to the banquet. David's name comes up. Jonathan speaks well of David and says, David has gone to Bethlehem to offer a sacrifice, and I gave him my blessing to do that. Well, he didn't have long to wait to find out the answer of Saul's true intent. In chapter 20, down in verse 30, we read that Saul's anger flared up at Jonathan, and he said to him, you son of a perverse and rebellious woman, don't I know that you've sided with the son of Jesse to your own shame and to the shame of the mother who bore you? As long as the son of Jesse lives on this earth, neither you nor your kingdom will be established. Now send and bring him to me, for he must die. Jonathan gets up from the table and he's angry, and there's a rift now between Jonathan and his father. And so he goes out and he is ready to share this bad news with David. David knew it all along. And they made a secret arrangement. And the arrangement was that Jonathan would go out and he would pretend to be practicing using his bow and arrow. And the boy that ran to fetch the arrows would run out, and David would be in hiding. And so he would shoot the arrow, and the arrangement was, if Jonathan called out to the young boy and said, no, the arrow's back this side of you, then that meant, David, it's okay, come on home. But if he shouted to the boy, the arrow's beyond you, keep going, then that would be the signal for David to run for his life. And having had this explosion at the dinner table, he shot the arrow, and when the young boy goes out, Jonathan says, it's way beyond you. Keep going. Keep going. And so he sends the boy back to the palace, and David comes out of hiding, and they say their farewells. Look in verse 41 there of chapter 20. After the boy had gone, David got up from the south side of the stone, and he bowed down before Jonathan three times with his face to the ground. Then they kissed each other and wept together, but David wept the most. And Jonathan said to David, go in peace, for we have sworn friendship with each other in the name of the Lord, saying, the Lord is witness between you and me and between your descendants and my descendants. Then David left, and Jonathan went back to the town. A sad farewell. You know, Scripture says there is a friend that sticks closer than a brother. David's own blood brothers had ridiculed him. They had put him down, made fun of him. But Jonathan proved to be a true friend. So David now begins his fugitive years. He ran from place to place. He was chased by Saul and his armed men. But we read about he and Jonathan one more time here in this book. It's down in chapter 23, verse 15. And there we read that while David was at Horesh in the desert of Ziph, he learned that Saul had come out to take his life. And Saul's son Jonathan went to David at Horesh, and he helped him find strength in God. Don't be afraid, he said. My father Saul will not lay a hand on you. You will be king over Israel, and I will be second to you. Even my father Saul knows this. The two of them made a covenant before the Lord, and then Jonathan went home, but David remained at Horesh. How hard is it when one of your friends is succeeding and you're failing? How hard is it to rejoice with them? Jonathan was the rightful heir to the throne, and yet it became apparent that David was going to be the new heir. Jonathan acknowledged this before David. He reestablished his love and his friendship for David, and he assured him of God's blessing. But he gives him a gift that is the greatest gift a friend can ever give to another. It says there in that text, he helped him find strength in the Lord. You know who my best friends are on this planet? They're not just the ones who give me an encouraging pat on the back, although I love that. And they're not just the ones who give me a pep talk when I need it, and there are times when I need it. My best friends are the ones who can come along beside me and pray with me and help me find strength in the Lord. Oh, those friends are so rare. They're so valuable. Well, the next time we hear about Jonathan, it's the sad news that Jonathan and his father Saul have been killed in battle. And David tore his robes and burst into tears. And he wrote a lament, and it's contained in 2 Samuel chapter 1. Of Jonathan, he wrote these words, "How the mighty have fallen in battle. Jonathan lies slain on your heights. I grieve for you, Jonathan, my brother. You were very dear to me." And there it would end, but for one final footnote in Scripture. Long after Jonathan is gone, David is now king. The descendants of Saul have all been slaughtered. That is, almost all have been slaughtered. And David must have been thinking about that dear friend who he had lost so many years before. And he must have been thinking about that promise that they had made each other that day when the boy was looking for the arrow. When they had said, "The Lord is witness between you and me and between your descendants and my descendants forever." And so in 2 Samuel chapter 9 in verse 1, David one day, as he sat in the palace, asked this question of his attendants. David asked, "Is there anyone still left of the house of Saul to whom I can show kindness for Jonathan's sake?" They had sworn to be true to their descendants forever. And so David asked this question, and they do a search throughout the land, and it just so happened that one of Jonathan's little babies, back in all this turmoil, little boy named Mephibosheth, was being cared for by his nurse, and as the armies came in, the nurse was running, and she fell and dropped that little baby, and he was paralyzed in both of his feet. And he had been in hiding all these years. All of his kinfolks had been slaughtered. He was in fear of David. He lived out in the desert in poverty. And when David is told that there is one, it's a descendant, a son of Jonathan, he says, "Go get him. Bring him to the palace." That poor boy must have been terrified, thinking that his head was about to be lost now that he'd been found out. And David brings him to the palace. Look down in verse 11, the last part of verse 11. "So Mephibosheth ate at David's table like one of the king's sons." He brought that boy in, and out of his love for his friend, he honored his promise, and Mephibosheth's life changed drastically. And the last verse, verse 13 of chapter 9, says, "And Mephibosheth lived in Jerusalem because he always ate at the king's table, and he was crippled in both feet." Well, what a friendship. What a beautiful story of what it means to have a friend in need and what it means to be a friend and honor the commitments to a lifelong friend. Folks, let me tell you, you'll never be more blessed than by your friendships. We sang that song just a few moments ago. What a friend we have in Jesus. We know He's the best, but I hope we can emulate Him in the way we respond to one another, the kind of friendships that we offer to one another. And I hope that this week we'll all work on being better friends to those people who are so valuable in our lives. If you've never responded to the best friend you can ever have, His name is Jesus. We sing another song sometimes, I'll be a friend to Jesus. And I hope that we can all be that friend to Him that He's been to us. If you need to come tonight, we invite you to do that as we stand and sing.